Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, evilist Carol Parrish Jameson helps me cover the Battle of Whispering Wood. We talk about Kat and Rob and Jaime and a little bit of Tyrion, too. Also, if you've ever wondered, how do knights urinate? This is the episode for you. In my bird's eye view section, I include a short excerpt of my conversation with Steve Osborne from Perfect Stranger Things. This is us covering the first episode of season 4. Steve and I are having a ton of fun doing it, and I don't mind saying that that particular podcast is an opportunity for both Steve and I to talk more autobiographically than we do in this podcast. But don't take my word for it. Here is an endorsement from my daughter, Nessa.
Listen to Perfect Stranger Things. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, without further ado, here is medievalist Carol Parrish Jameson. I was just texting my sister, Tara, and I said, I'm about to interview an expert on medieval knights. Do you have any questions for her? And so she came up with a question just on the spot. And I wonder if we could just try you with this question.
Okay.
Tara writes, how does one pee in a suit of armor?
Okay.
I'll be honest. I'd never considered this before. But now I really want to know.
And in depictions, you know, of in movies and such, in depictions, they don't cover that part of it, of course, at all. In, you know, on the battlefield, especially early on, normally they were wearing chainmail. And so it would be, you know, they wouldn't be in the full plate armor. Mm-hmm. Plate armor was really because it was impractical. It was heavy. So it was really reserved more for like jousting and that kind of thing. Sure. And I don't think you could pee in it.
Okay. All right. No, this is good for me to know. So when I've seen men wearing like a cod piece, was that more decorative than anything else then?
I think that was for protection, much like the cup that baseball players wear.
Right.
But I might be wrong. I am not an expert on the cod piece, Anthony.
All right. Well, we will relay this to Tara and see if this satisfies her query. Then. No, I appreciate that. All right. So today we're covering Catelyn's 10th POV chapter. And I think that many fans will recognize this as the famous Battle of Whispering Woods. Carol, I'll just go ahead and read my synopsis and we can jump right in.
Sure.
Okay. Catelyn, along with the bulk of Robb's army, is waiting in the woods. The plan is for a group of raiders to draw Jaime Lannister out from his siege at River Run, isolate his army, and capture him. Kat waits and waits and remember all of the times she's waited for men to return in her life. She observes that Rob has become a naturally gifted lord, but she worries over him nonetheless and steels herself against the harsh realities of battle. Finally, she catches a glimpse of Jaime and his men. Indeed, as her uncle promised, Jaime Lannister has been drawn out into the wood unsuspecting. The battle begins. Although Kat hears it, she doesn't see much of it as it is obscured by the trees. But at the end of it, Rob returns victorious with Jaime as a hostage. Kat shares a brief conversation with Jaime before he is locked and guarded. Theon wants to revel in the win, but Kat and Rob stoically look forward to retaking River Run. So, Carol Parrish Jameson, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a couple of things that I definitely want us to touch on. I am just coming off teaching a class on Beowulf and medievalism. Mm. And I know that you've had a discussion already on your show about Catelyn and the role of women, but I think that this chapter also contributes to that discussion.
Good.
I'd like to continue there a little bit. And then I'd like to talk about this battle and the really interesting perspective that we're getting of this battle is so different from the battle scene that we got in the previous chapter, because it's all from Catelyn's observation.
This is a very different, again, obscured view of the battle. Really, we hear a lot of the battle. We don't see a lot of the battle. So, yeah, I'm interested. I mean, both in sort of what Kat brings to the story, but also how she how she experiences this part of medieval life.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so it opens up. I'm thinking about it struck me how she's waiting. And this is a chapter, you know, about waiting. And so what came to mind for me was just this image of the waiting woman, really in you know, the Middle Ages and medieval literature and beyond.
Mm.
And I'm thinking in Anglo-Saxon poetry of the wife's lament. It's this very esoteric poem, but it's pretty clear that the wife is waiting on her husband. We can jump ahead to Chaucer with the Franklin's Tale, where Dorigen, a lady is waiting for her husband, and she's so afraid that when he comes home, he'll get shattered by the rocks that wait in the bay. And then, you know, I'm from Savannah, and that's another thing that got me thinking about waiting women. There is a statue here on the river called the Waving Girl Statue. And the story is that apparently this woman would just stand and wave to sailors, but there is another legend that she was waiting on her lover to come back from war. So
one is much more romantic than the other.
Exactly. And I think the one that she just liked to wave that is probably the true one. But
more plausible.
Right. And then I was also, it brought to mind historical character. Have you heard of Edith of the Swan's Neck?
No.
What a great name. Isn't that a great name?
Yeah.
She was the mistress of Harold I of England. And the legend is that during the Norman conquest, she and Harold's mother waited and listened to the battle from a distance.
Mm.
And then afterwards, I don't know whether this is, I think this is probably more folklore than fact, but it's also a great story. Afterwards, she had to identify Harold's body. He was so mutilated.
Mm.
Yeah. So again, just that image of waiting women. And though Catelyn in this case is not like, she's not waiting at home. She's like waiting right there
right
on the battlefield.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because she really does have a unique perspective on this. It's from the ancient world, and I would imagine bleeding into the medieval world, there is an idea of domestic space being feminine space, right?
Right, yeah.
So for a woman, even a high lady, to actually be on the battlefield and have any kind of view of the workings of war would be unique, wouldn't it?
It would. George R. R. Martin, in one of the interviews that he gave, compared Catelyn to Eleanor of Aquitaine, who actually, you know, was something of a military advisor and who apparently led some troops into the Second Crusade. And so I think Catelyn is maybe ultimately more in that vein, even though we do see her here at this point waiting.
Right, right. Well, all right, I did want to save this for later, but maybe I'll ask you this now. So we meet a character named Daisy Mormont.
Yes.
And she's described as this, you know, lithe woman of 6 feet and able to wield a morning star. And, you know, some of the men grumble, like, why is she on the battlefields? You know, in other words, she's an aberration, but she is going to fight. She does fight.
She is. Mm-hmm.
And totally not in the show at all, but I think in some way an inspiration for Lyanna Mormont.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I guess the question is, like, I mean, we have characters like Joan of Arc. Is this a work of complete fiction, or do we have a few precedents for you know, women on the battlefields during this period?
It's definitely an anomaly. It's definitely the exception, you know, rather than the rule. But, you know, it was possible. It is interesting, the men balking about Daisy Mormont, but Catelyn doesn't care. She has a mission. Mm-hmm. She's there, you know, as a strategist. But you know, and certainly in the literary world, it's very unusual that you see a woman in battle. There's one romance called Silence, and it's about a woman who disguises herself as a man so she can keep her inheritance, and she's able to go out and fight.
Sure.
But it isn't typically the woman's domain is, you know, waiting. It's more domestic.
And I do think that Kat's advocacy for this, I guess we really can't call her a knight, but mm-hmm. this female knight is a foreshadowing of her eventual relationship for Brienne.
Yes. Right?
I mean, because you could imagine that most highborn folk, well, most folk in general, are going to defend the traditional gender norms.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting that Kat seems to be an advocate here. That seems to be in keeping with what we find out about her later.
Yes, yes. And she is, you know, she has a mission here. Her mission is the survival of her son and, you know, and getting her family back mm-hmm. together. And I think she's going to achieve that mission however she sees fit. And here is someone that she knows is a very capable warrior, female, male. Mm-hmm. You know, she's out to reunite her family and to win this battle.
Right. Let me read just a little bit of the book here, because what's great about this chapter is the detailed depiction of what Kat hears, and wasn't able to capture it in my summary. So I'll just read this this portion. Afterward, she could not claim she had seen the battle, yet she could hear, and the valley rang with echoes. The crack of the broken lance, the clash of swords, the cries of Lannister and Winterfell, and Tully, River Run and Tully. When she realized there was no more to see, she closed her eyes and listened. The battle came alive around her. She heard hoofbeats, iron boots splashing in shallow water, the woody sound of swords on oaken shields, and the scrape of steel against steel, the hiss of arrows, and the thunder of drums, and the terrified screaming of 1,000 horses. Men shouted curses and begged for mercy, and got it or not, and lived or died. The ridges seemed to play queer tricks with sound. Once she heard Rob's voice, clear as if he'd been standing at her side, calling, "To me, to me." And she heard his direwolf snarling and growling, heard the snap of those long teeth and the tearing of flesh, shrieks of fear and pain from man and horse alike. Was there only one wolf? It was hard to be certain. Little by little, the sound dwindled and died, until at last there was only the one wolf. As a red dawn broke in the east, gray wind began to howl again. So I thought it was an interesting way to depict a battle.
It is, yeah. I think it's beautifully written, though, the imagery and
yeah.
and in the text, the way that he uses italics here to kind mm-hmm. of emphasize some of the points that that she's hearing. But yeah, I find it just really gripping. It's almost like a horror movie. And sometimes the things that you can't see are the things that are scariest,
right.
The things that are implied.
Yes. Absolutely, that's true. And I think that by choosing to focus on just the sounds of battle, it's a very clever way to focus on a particular aspect of warfare. And yeah, I absolutely appreciated it. You don't see it a lot. We don't get a lot of this in this book.
You really don't. And again, especially coming off that previous chapter where we are just in the thick of the battle with, you know, with Tyrion and, you know, just seeing, you know, everything up close and so graphically.
Yeah,
and here,
sure.
here again, it's just the noises, and it's so ominous to
uh-huh.
me, you know, the whole, they're having to whisper, the quietness of the woods and the birds, the snow shrikes. In the moments before we started talking, I did something someone shouldn't do in those moments before. I went down the rabbit hole of looking up shrikes because
sure.
I didn't know they were real birds. Did you know that?
Oh, no, I did not. I thought that they were invented for this story.
Yeah, it, because I was thinking about in Anglo-Saxon poetry, particularly in poems like the Battle of Maldon and the Finnsburg Fragment and other works that depict war, there are always, you know, animals of prey, and especially mm-hmm. birds are depicted. And so I think she hears the shrikes at one point. And what I found is that they are carnivorous birds, and their name means butcher, and it comes from a folkloric narrative about them. Yeah, yeah, that apparently they're called butcher birds.
Interesting. Now I read that a little differently.
Okay, how did you read that?
So I read that as these are northern birds that you would only hear up north. And and the northern armies are using that particular bird call to alert everyone else.
That well could be, yeah.
That the Lannisters have been spotted and they're on their way. Mm-hmm. You know, she hears it four times and then immediately she's told, you know, they're here.
So I would bet that's right, yeah.
So I thought, now the text doesn't do that work for me. I kind of have to supply that.
That was some good supplying.
But I did think it's kind of a clever way to, and I didn't know that whole thing about the butchers thing, but it's a clever way to say, well, who are the butcher birds in this story? It's the northern it's the northern warriors. They're about to butcher the Lannister forces,
right? And this really plays out the whole notion of this what comes to be known as Battle of the Whispering Woods, because they are trying to be very, very quiet. That's why that you know the sounds that she hears are you know before the battle begins, you know, the clinking of the chainmail and such. So they need some way to communicate.
Yeah.
Without giving themselves away.
Yeah, how do you keep an army of, you know, 18,000 quiet?
Yeah, I guess
a
shrike.
The horses are going to snort, and the horses are going to disturb the ground below them, and so, yeah. So everyone's whispering, but that's as much as you could hope to keep silent, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now I wanted to ask you. You mentioned, and this is a little bit of a rewind here, but I wanted to ask you. In the previous chapter, which you mentioned Tyrion, there's this episode where he's on the battlefield and there's a northern knight who, or Tyrion identifies him as a knight, who recognizes Tyrion and says, you know, do you yield? Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, is in terms of chivalry... Is that a strategic move or is that a sort of a move of honor?
Yeah, it can be both. One should show mercy on the battlefield, number one. But secondly, you would recognize Tyrion. There probably aren't many dwarfs, and so it's quite possible that they also realize that this is someone who could be much more valuable to them as a captive,
right? Sure.
Just as happens with Jaime.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense with Tyrion. But I guess I'm just wondering, in general, let's say this code defines the knight, right?
Mm-hmm,
but
right,
is there a part of the code that is very detailed about how one demonstrate chivalry on the battlefield?
Yeah, there definitely are rules of battle. If someone asks for mercy, then one should always show mercy. In this case, I don't recall Tyrion isn't going to ask for mercy.
He decides to put his spike into the horse's belly.
Right, you know? And ends up defeating the guy.
Right.
So in that situation, he did not. Maybe simply because he recognizes that it's not fair, that he has an unfair advantage over Tyrion by size, and maybe he's being chivalric and, you know, recognizing that this would not be fair. And so he's offering him mercy. Maybe he recognizes that he's a Lannister.
Sure. Bringing this back to the chapter that we're looking at now, Theon is an interesting voice in Rob's ear.
Yes.
In addition to sort of taking maybe a little bit too much pleasure in this horrific battle, he also wants to just behead Jaime Lannister.
He does, yeah.
And of course, Rob says, of course, you know, my father would never do something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So he's really listening to the voice of his father in his head. But it makes me wonder about Theon. Either he's foolish or he's looking out for his own interests. Like maybe, like I did wonder in this chapter, does he want Rob to sue for peace here and use the hostages to sort of avert war? Or is Theon the kind of guy who is sort of goading Rob into making a poor decision?
I think it's the latter. I think Theon is definitely guilty of overmode, excessive pride. He thinks in the moment, and he's arrogant, And I don't think he strategizes. And of course, Martin's setting him up for this huge fall. So, so that, you know, he portrays him, you know, the arrogance is built to this crescendo. Uh-huh. And when he falls, boy, does he fall. But yeah, Theon, to me, I don't see a lot of thought or strategy at all. He's just in that moment of the battle, mm-hmm. You know, and in that moment of glory. And he does, he just almost seems to be egging things on.
Mm-hmm. Because capturing Jaime is sort of a step toward peace from one perspective.
Right.
You're thinking, we've got one of you, we've got a really valuable hostage of yours. You, clearly you have the Lord of Winterfell. Maybe we make this trade and we go our merry way. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if maybe Theon is actually strategizing and thinking, no, it's better for me if this war continues. The more this war continues, the better my prospects for the future will be. You know, in other words, maybe he's sort of trying to sow the seeds of chaos in a way that maybe Littlefinger would. But maybe I'm giving him too much credit.
I don't give him that much credit. It's possible, but just maybe the other knee-jerk reactions that we see him having throughout the course of the narrative sometimes are good, right? He saves Bran early on by that kind of a knee-jerk reaction.
So I want to know about, I'm assuming you want to bring this to Beowulf and maybe some of the female characters of Beowulf?
Yeah. Let's return then to Catelyn, because when she's sitting there waiting, what's running through her head are all of her roles, right? All of the roles that she's had as a female in this society. And they do, they really do parallel the roles that you see in Beowulf. And again, well, I know that you went over a lot of these in a previous podcast. It was fascinating, but I do think there's some things that this chapter adds to it.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Yeah, she starts, you know, thinking about her father, her role as a daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, you get married and you are supposed to then, you know, you go with your husband's family, but she's a Tully, and the Tullys, isn't it? Is it family, duty, honor?
Yeah, sure.
Family. And she, she is very devoted to her father and remains very devoted. So as she's sitting here waiting and thinking about all of her roles, that's the first role that comes to mind, is that role of daughter and waiting on her father.
I mean, it's an odd thing for a father to say that to a kid.
Yeah, it seems kind of cruel.
You know, wait for me. You know, look out your window until I return and wait for me.
And there's no guarantee, right, in this kind of a society.
Yeah, she could be waiting forever. Mm-hmm. Or who knows how long you're going to be gone. You could be gone for months. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a little bit
That would definitely mess with your head if you were a little kid in that situation.
And maybe that's kind of shows you how little someone like Hoster Tully even imagines himself in the shoes of a little girl, right?
Yeah, right. I think, that if he were being considerate of what it's really like for that child waiting on her father, he wouldn't have said that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then she goes from there to her role as a peace weaver, her betrothal to Brendan Stark, and then she has to marry the younger brother. So that role of peace weaver comes up.
And remind me again, if for people who didn't hear that previous podcast, what is a peace weaver?
A peace weaver is a woman who is basically married off in an exchange, oftentimes with like an enemy or a potential enemy or someone that a family might want to become allies with in order to seal peace, in order to ensure peace. So by marrying into the Stark family, that would help ensure an alliance between the Tullys and the Starks.
Right. Okay.
And that is why she is married off to the younger brother, to Ned, when Brendan dies, that they can keep that alliance.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So then she reflects back on how she was supposed to marry Brandon Stark. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, he promised he'd be right back and he never came back. And she ends up sort of marrying his brother as the stand-in.
And she waited on her dad all that time, and he always came back. So that had to be kind of hard to take that this one didn't come back.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, so then she's married off to the younger brother, and he comes back, but he comes back with a strange baby.
Right. That's right. And she also remembers to her birthing bed, right? And
she does.
She thinks, okay, well, at least Ned left me something before he rode off to war. Here he is before me, you know, and he's anything but a baby now, but she absolutely can't look at him and not think about him as a baby.
This is such a chapter about motherhood.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I think I can so relate to it in that way. Her role here is mother, and she's trying to now she's waiting on her son, and that's a an altogether different kind of waiting. You know, she's sitting here watching her son, and then when he goes off into the battle, she doesn't know if he'll be back or not. She doesn't know about the safety of her daughters.
Yeah.
She's got a son that is injured, so she's in a pretty bad situation here. But yeah, I think Martin does such a good job of describing the angst that she feels here as a mother. I think the prayer that she says is every mother's prayer: let him live to see 25, 30.
Right. Yeah.
And I also relate, when she talks about that transformation, about she sees him without his helmet on, and then he puts the helmet on, and suddenly, he's a man, he's a knight.
Oh, he's a knight. Yeah. It's like this otherworldly transformation.
Yeah. And I personally relate to that because I have a child who attended a military academy.
Oh.
And you take your child, she was 17, and you drop them off. And I dropped off a 17-year-old little girl in a t-shirt and shorts, and they invite you back the next day, when the basic training begins. But the next day you watch them all march out onto the field, and they come out in full armor, and you just are like, oh my goodness, what's happened?
Yeah, some kind of transformation happens, right?
Yeah, that you're not ready for. Yeah, I don't think you can ever be ready to see that kind of transformation. She's seen Rob train all his life, right, to become a warrior of sorts. But I think it's that moment where she sees him without the helmet, with his hair, that the face she loves so much, and then he puts the helmet on, and it's like this automatic transformation in her mind.
Right. So connecting to Beowulf, So I just wanted to make sure that people knew that. The previous podcast that we were talking about was with Chris Swank.
Right, yes.
And Chris has written an essay called The Peace Weavers of Winterfell in a book called Queenship and the Women of Westeros. So anyway, I just wanted to call that out. People wanted to try to look for that previous podcast.
Yeah, it is an excellent podcast and an excellent article. So
let's say, imagine us adding on to some of the insights that Chris had. What made you think of Beowulf when you were reading this chapter?
Looking at all the different roles that that Catelyn assumes, from peace weaver to being a mother, to being what she becomes later on when she transforms into Lady Stoneheart.
Right. Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so she...
I forgot about the Lady Stoneheart transformation.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, of course... Yes, she becomes a monster, right?
She does. So. And in Beowulf, you see there's a lot about mothers and sons. You see mothers concerned for their sons. I think that that's one way in Anglo-Saxon society that a female could have power is through her sons, especially if she's a noble woman. And Grendel's mother seeks vengeance on behalf of course, her son.
And eventually this is what will happen with Kat. She will become a revenge monster.
Yeah. But I would almost argue that there's something in Catelyn that's a little bit cold-hearted, that I can understand a mother's vengeance, but I think there's something else in her that kind of justifies the title Stoneheart. And I don't know, I might be in the minority for thinking this.
I don't think so. I think there are a couple hints in this first book that are like a cold hand grabbed her heart.
Right.
Her heart felt as cold as stone or something like that. And
yeah.
Usually this happens when she's imagining mm-hmm. the men who have killed because of choices she's made.
Yes. Yeah. Because she does end up making some bad choices. I'm thinking of that. And also, you know, she's a loving mother to her own children, but she's a wicked stepmother too. Something we don't see in Beowulf.
But, yeah, she is.
There's, I don't know, kind of a little bit of a cold-heartedness there. And is it in the series, don't they let her have a moment of regret for her treatment of Jon Snow?
Yeah, and she reflects. She reflects to, in the show, she's named Talisa, but she reflects to Talisa that she was horrible to Jon, and that, she, you know, maybe the gods are punishing her for her inability to keep her promise that she will treat Jon, you know, in a way that a mother would treat a son. Mm-hmm. Not in the books.
Not in the books at all. There's no. There's no remorse. In that way, she doesn't attempt to be a peace weaver, mm-hmm. at least within her own family. She, in fact, kind of sows mm-hmm. discord.
Well, and I was thinking, I think early on, I had a guest named Stephanie Barbie Hammer, and she was pointing out to me that in the works of Shakespeare, you'll often have these bastards who were a threat to the family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I almost feel like maybe that's how Kat views Jon Snow. Like he's not a threat yet.
Right.
This is a fly in the ointment.
It is. And the fact that Ned will not identify the mother, the fact that they're so close in age, she would have a right. Yeah, I can understand that would be a fear for her, that this child might become Ned's favorite, that Ned might choose this child as uh-huh. heir over her own.
Or her other, let's say, imagine her other sons die, which mm-hmm. happens, right?
So, right, yeah.
And then Jon becomes the only living, you know, son of Ned Stark,
mm-hmm.
Ned decides to legitimize him.
Yeah.
Where does that leave Catelyn? I don't know where that leaves Catelyn.
Yeah, and that is her fear. Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And that is a fear that we've seen historically as well.
Right. I wanted to ask you about more about knights, if that's okay.
Okay.
All right, so in this chapter, Rob's army has grown.
Mm-hmm.
And it's grown for a couple reasons. It's grown because more lords have sort of flocked to him and brought their armies. Mm-hmm. But there's also a line that says, but then also, you know, a variety of hedge knights have glommed on to the army. Now, in my line of work, in my era of history, I can recognize that there is a difference between scribes and scribes.
Mm-hmm.
In a world that's, you know, mostly illiterate, a scribe could just be like a secretary that that helps you write a letter,
mm-hmm.
or a scribe could be like a legal genius that advises a king.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm imagining that knights are a little bit like that too. Like you can have a knight who's revered, who sort of advises at court, but there's also a lot of other sort of hodgepodge knights around.
There are, yeah.
So I wonder, could you talk about the stratification of sort of that role of knight?
A lot of that stratification has to do with social status and money.
Okay.
It takes money to be a knight.
Right.
So, you know, if you're from a family that's of the lower nobility, or later in the Middle Ages, if you were from a family, you know, bourgeois family that was able to buy land and title, then you could, you know, you could maybe become a knight, but you wouldn't be of the same status as a nobly born knight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Martin has this word hedge knight.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is here is a pretty, pretty poor knight who, you know, sort of mm-hmm. trotting up and down the road mm-hmm. and sleeping in the hedges.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to think about that. I don't know how, should I be thinking about knights in medieval France this way, for instance?
Well, you know, in times of warfare, you would have to recruit from, you know, farmlands, and, you know, you'd need people on the battlefield, especially foot soldiers. There uh-huh. wouldn't be enough of the nobility. So you would have to recruit in that way. But I think Martin's kind of romanticized view of the hedge knight is just that.
Right. Okay. All right, this leads to my next question. All right, should I be thinking about knights as policemen who govern the roads and look for ways to show honor in peacetime, who occasionally happen to be warriors? Or should I think of knights as warriors who occasionally have to govern the peace when it's not wartime?
The former is more accurate.
Okay. All right. So we're more like policemen who sometimes need to act as warriors.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
And simply also they're members of the nobility, and the nobility has the power, and so they're able, you know, they're going to enforce, you know, the king's rules and such.
That's helpful to me. In many ways, you know, you wonder, like, what do warriors do in peacetime? Mm-hmm. Right? So, I mean, hopefully they're farming and doing other things besides.
And the literary depictions aren't that helpful because, you know, that's not the fun part to read. So there aren't many depictions in literature of knights at leisure.
Okay.
And when they are at leisure, they're jousting or they're playing chess. Mm-hmm. Wooing ladies.
Sure, of course. Wooing ladies they ought not to be wooing.
Yes, yes. But it's interesting thinking of nice Rob and Jamie and their different brands of heroism in this chapter also were very striking to me.
Oh, tell me more.
Well, so Jamie gets captured and I don't hate Jamie. In the novels, I think Jamie is on this trajectory towards redemption that, I don't know, you know, Martin might adhere to what happens to him in the series where things don't go so well. But I see Jamie on this kind of arc of improvement. And so, you know, at this point, he's not there yet.
No.
But there are things about him that are, dare I say, that are admirable. He has his weaknesses.
Well, yeah, even in this chapter, I think that he's portrayed as heroic. He you can't fault him for being as good as he is at what he does,
and they acknowledge
even though
that.
He was an enemy.
Right. He has the same similar kind of flaw to Theon in that he's got a little bit of overconfidence. He's rash. They know he's not going to be able to stay put, that if they, you know, entice him, that he will not stay at the point of the siege, that he'll come out. And that's how they're able ultimately to entrap him, is through that overconfidence. Mm-hmm. But when he makes that last stand effort, when it looks like, you know, that he's surrounded, he makes his last ditch effort to get at Rob, which is kind of the heroic thing to do if you want to take down this this opposing force. And he's only captured because doesn't his sword get caught in somebody's head or neck when he...
Yeah, he kind of makes a joke about it. He says, he's kneeling before Kat and he says, well, I'd offer you my sword, but I misplaced it.
And dare I say that I admire that he's witty and brazen, even in captivity.
Uh-huh. That's right. And we find out later how he misplaced it. How did he lose it? Well, he lost it in the skull of one of your, you know, your young lords.
Yeah, making, again, this effort that almost reminds me of the last battle between, you know, Arthur and Mordred, when it's down to the two of them. And, you know, Arthur gets his way across the battlefield, even though it's fatal to him, so that he can kill off Mordred once and for all. That it's heroic because Jaime, you know, he's surrounded here, but he's going to make an effort. You know, and he keeps that sense of humor, probably not at all funny, to Catelyn. When doesn't he say, I mislaid your daughters as well, when she asks?
Yeah. Yeah, she said, I don't want your sword. I want my daughters. I want my husband.
Yeah,
I misplaced those too. Sorry.
Yeah, maybe a bit of a cruel humor there, but
But
you know, they acknowledge this about him, and I guess what makes Rob strategically so effective here is that he's listened to his uncle's advice about Jamie's his weakness is his strength, and that's that he's so filled with prowess that. He almost can't control it, Jamie.
At the same time, I feel like I should mention, he pushed a little boy out a window.
He did.
he's absolutely, in many ways, he just, He just has no scruples.
He doesn't. You know, I can't defend him on that. His his thoughts are the protection of his own family, but that is a child. It's inexcusable. So yeah, he's ruthless in a way that I think it is very hard to relate to. But there is a code there that he follows, whether, you know, we can reconcile it or not.
It's his own code. He sort of has come up with his own ideas about what it means to... I've always thought of him as sort of viewing himself almost in artistic terms. Almost like, I am a practitioner of the high art of swordplay. Mm-hmm. And I am going to throw everything I have into that.
Yeah.
That's sort of my highest end to do that. Which is, I think, why he takes these men out himself at any chance he gets. It's more of a chance for him to practice his craft.
Right, yeah. And then once he loses that ability, that's when he really has to reinvent himself. Because that's all he was. That's, you know, that defined him.
He was that.
Yeah.
Hand, right?
We're in contrast. If we look at Rob, I think Rob has a very clear cut code, a very clear cut, even though he's not technically a knight, clear cut chivalric code. But I think he gets caught in it too.
It's interesting. It feels like when Rob, now we don't have an interior view to either Rob or Jamie.
Right. Yeah.
But I will say that oftentimes Rob will vocalize Ned's voice. Mm-hmm. He'll say things like, well, my father has always said that the men want to see you before the battle. Right. So maybe I should ride up and down the lines.
Yeah, almost like Forrest Gump. Mama always said, only here it really is sound advice of his father.
Oh, that's a great analogy. Yeah, no, he's always vocalizing Ned's voice. I don't hear that at all from Jamie. I don't ever hear him say, well, you know, what would my dad do in this situation?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he might think like, you know, what would, you know, Sir Arthur Dayne do?
Right,
or,
you know,
some great swordsman that he admires. But
and that's interesting because Tywin puts so much faith in Jaime. He believes that, you know, that Jaime is going to win this battle for him. He has no idea.
He put so much faith in Jaime and so little faith in Tyrion. And Tyrion ends up, you know, actually being pretty good.
Right. And Jaime is captured.
Yeah. And Jaime's captured.
Yeah. Yeah. But, but Rob here, you know, in this chapter, we see Rob just kind of it's just, I think, a couple of chapters later where he's declared King of the North, if I'm recalling right. And I think we really see him being set up for that. We don't get into his head, but we see him, you know, wanting to see his men first. Catelyn sees him moving among the men, offering them, you know, the words of comfort and, you know, consulting the map, you know, that to see how to strategize and where to place his men. And he's able to take, you know, good advice. He takes his mother's advice. She's trying to straddle that boundary herself between being advisor and mommy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
And listening to his uncle's advice as well. That's the reason I think he doesn't listen to Theon.
Right. But
it's, I do think ultimately though that honor gets the best of his father, where he hears his father's voice. Honor gets the best of his father, and I think honor gets the best of Rob, ultimately.
I was going to say the exact opposite. All right, let me make my case.
And then I'll make mine. Okay.
Yeah. I was going to say Ned dies dishonorably. He ends up lying, saying that he did betray the king. He conspired.
Well, yeah, I'm going to give you
and
that.
Yeah. And that Joffrey's the true king. He dishonors himself and dies for it.
Right.
Rob dishonors himself by he can't keep his promise to Walder Frey.
Yes.
Marries Jane. Mm-hmm. And that's not honorable either. And that's why he dies. So tell me what you're thinking.
Okay, yeah, I agree with all of that. Except I think that his decision to marry Jane is honorable in his mind. I think he feels he's dishonoring her if he doesn't marry her.
Interesting.
Because he slept with her. So he's got.
Oh, interesting.
So he's caught between oaths as well, because he's caught between the oath that's made to Frey to marry the Frey daughter, but he also, he'll dishonor her if he, Jane, if he doesn't marry Jane. So he's kind of in the same no-win situation as Jamie.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I see. Yeah, and maybe he chooses the promise to Jane, or the choice not to dishonor Jane, over the choice to marry the Frey daughter, because he didn't really make that promise. His mother made that promise.
Sure.
But there are grave consequences.
Well, I mean, okay. I do think, and maybe this is all moot, but I do think that sometimes teenage boys will make decisions and try to convince themselves that it was the best decision after the fact.
Right, yeah.
Right? So he's making the decision, you know, just based on his hormones, and then his brain gets involved after the fact and think, well, actually, actually, this isn't the worst decision I've ever made. And it'd be the honorable thing if I, if I did right by this woman. I don't know if honor is what gets Ned killed, and I'm not sure that honor is what gets Rob killed.
Yeah, I'm gonna take back what I said about Ned. I think you're right. He's faulted for his honor by various characters throughout, but you're right. He's so honorable up until that very ending point, where then he does have to put his honor on the line.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
I want to talk about another show difference.
Okay.
I imagine that because of your line of work, you sort of enjoyed the show differently than most people enjoyed the show. And I'm wondering, so I think for me, if someone like DC Mormont had been introduced in the first season, you know, female knight, and she was sort of played up, you could imagine the showrunners thinking, well, we kind of need a female badass in this show. Mm-hmm. And here, Martin's written one. There she is, right on the page. Let's bring her into the story and give her, you know, a little bit of a bigger role, or at least show her on the battlefield. Mm-hmm. I think that that would have been delightful in my view, but I think my guess is that for someone who is well studied in the medieval world, that might have actually, you might have bumped on that a little bit.
You know, because I'm also so interested in medievalism and how we bring these stories into current times, I think I would have been all right with that. Mm-hmm. I would have been really interested in how that worked out. As I said, I've just taught this class on Beowulf and medievalism, and the most recent novels that are kind of revisions of the Beowulf story feature Grendel's mother as the protagonist. Mm-hmm. So I would have been interested for that way, but as a purist medievalist, as far as like, is this an accurate depiction of the Middle Ages and the kind of literature that you see, in that way, it would have been an anomaly.
Yeah. And I do think by removing Daisy from the story, it almost allows a greater punch from Brienne later
on.
Yeah,
I think he is saving it up for Brienne.
I mean, it really does show her as sort of this this aberration on the landscape, right?
Yes, yeah. And then the series also has the younger Mormont. Is it a Mormont, the younger girl?
Lyanna Mormont ends up being the heir of Bear Island or something.
Yeah, she kind of has that same, that spunk, right?
Yes, that's right.
So maybe they're, you know, maybe that's what they're doing instead.
And in the final season, she becomes a warrior.
She does. So maybe that's how they're working in this character.
Exactly.
But it's interesting because here, you know, some of the men are a bit disgruntled about her appearance, but she's just sort of casually thrown into the mix.
Yeah.
In a way that I kind of liked.
Yeah. I was just going to note some introductions, you noted already the snow shrikes. We meet and say goodbye to Darren Hornwood. Mm-hmm. Robin Flint, we meet for the first time. And notable departures, Torrin and Eddard Karstark are killed along with Darren. And of course, that sets up the discontent of Lord Karstark, which is going to be a problem for Rob later on.
Right.
And we've already talked about some show differences, but I will just note that I just rewatched the single scene that's represented in Baelor for the Battle of Whispering Woods. It really, you know, it shows Jaime's capture and it shows maybe, you know, 2 minutes of screen time. The entire battle is completely removed. And yeah. And so you really just get the aftermath of Jaime's capture in the show.
Yeah, which is, it shows how the book is able to capture something that the show just can't. They could have had another massive battle scene, but since it's from the perspective of Catelyn, that the show just couldn't capture that in the way that I think the book could.
Okay, is there anything else that you noticed or wanted to mention about this chapter before we wrap this?
I think we're all set up here for Rob to become the King of the North.
Yeah, set up to become the King of the North. And in many ways, this chapter gives us false hope.
Yeah.
Because here we have, you mentioned the chessboard before. Mm-hmm. Here we've captured really one of the most valuable pieces on the board. We have Jaime Lannister. You just imagine, like, okay, we have leverage. We're going to get Ned back.
Yeah.
Of course, we know that that's not going to happen. So.
Right. Yeah. And it will all come back to Catelyn and Catelyn's role as a mother.
It's interesting, like, I don't know how much those conversations that were represented in between Lucas and Dustin and Mike are representative of actual conversations people have, but it certainly is representative of the thought process. Like sure. Lucas is saying,
we don't have to be nerds anymore, right?
Right. Like I can do this. Let me infiltrate, and then that will, and that I can protect you. And that's folly, right? I mean, that's the folly of that middle school to high school transition, is the idea that no, we could still make this work, even though we clearly have diverging mm-hmm. interests. Mm-hmm. And they were like, there's still that, oh, we could do the cake and eat it too thing. And it's just not going to happen, right? So that felt pretty authentic. And what I liked is that what they've done is, and I mean, granted, I mean, obviously we're living in Hawkins where there's monsters all the time. And these people, these kids, you know, give them credit for never really, I mean, only Max needs therapy. Mm-hmm. Interesting. they see a lot of death, like a bunch, and they save the world a bunch. And yet they still, what the Duffer brothers do is they get you right back into the high school politics. Like, well, yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, you may be bonded yeah. by saving the world. But at the end of the day, it'd be nice to be a cool kid.
Well, and again, and here we go. I think what we have here is sort of a part two of the Barb and Nance problem of season one, right? Because
right,
Nancy right. was about to break into the new friend group, the popularity group, the party group. And Barb was like, this is a bad idea. You're going to chase popularity. That Steve Harrington's no good for you. And then Barb's left behind. And we know what happens to Barb, right?
That's right. This is what happens if you don't join the cool. You die.
if you die
inside,
at least. You're just not
at least.
Popular enough to live now.
Right. Yeah, the world doesn't need you.
Well, in the parallel here, we're not really at 11 yet, but she's a total yeah. target for these Southern California Valley girls.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season two.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
My thanks to Carol. My thanks to Steve. Again, if you're interested in Stranger Things and you'd like to hear Steve and I talk about it, do a search for Perfect Stranger Things wherever you search for podcasts. And that is all for this week.